The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. This means our invitation is open to all, and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. You are welcome. From Malcolm Gladwell's Talking to Strangers. Many years ago, when my parents came down to visit me in New York City, I decided to put them up at the Mercer Hotel. It was a bit of mischief on my part. The Mercer is chic and exclusive, the kind of place where the famous and the fabulous stay. My parents, and particularly my father, were oblivious to that kind of thing. My father did not watch television or go to the movies or listen to popular music. He would have thought People magazine was an anthropology journal. His areas of expertise were specific: mathematics, gardening, and the Bible. I came to pick up my parents for dinner and asked my father how his day had been. "Wonderful," he said. Apparently, he had spent the afternoon in conversation with a man in the lobby. This is fairly typical behavior for my father. He liked to talk to strangers. "What did you talk with him about?" I asked. "Gardening," my father says. "What was his name?" "Oh, I have no idea." But the whole time, people were coming up and taking pictures of him and having him sign little bits of paper. So if there's a Hollywood celebrity reading this who remembers chatting with a bearded Englishman long ago in the lobby of the Mercer Hotel, please contact me. For everyone else, consider this the lesson. Sometimes the best conversations between strangers allow the stranger to remain a stranger. Don't read this book. It'll just make you mad. First thing you need to know, I like Malcolm Gladwell. I've read a lot of his other books. I listen to his podcast. When I see an interview with him online, I stop and I watch the interview. I'm a fan. That said, I pretty much hate this book. If you're not familiar with his work, Malcolm Gladwell is a science popularizer. He's an interpreter. Because the problem we have is that the people who do the science and the people who do the marketing are completely different people. And the people who actually know what's going on and the people who make the decisions are different people. So you need someone to stand in the middle to translate. That's Gladwell. He's made a lifetime career out of translating science to normal people. He's a masterful writer, a storyteller, a popular of science. His books are a gift to the world. But we've all seen enough Christmases to know that some gifts are better than others. So here's the root of my problem. The way Gladwell works is he gets an idea. He hears something, he sees something, it catches him, and then he goes out into the world to explore that idea. And he talks to scientists, and he gathers information, he puts it together in a book on a topic. Basically, I want to grow up and be Malcolm Gladwell. Each of his books has a big idea. If you've read his stuff, then you know this. He had the one that was called Outliers, which is how come some people succeed so drastically and some people just don't. Like, how do you have a world with like the Beatles and just people? How does that happen? He wrote a whole book about it. Or another book was, how do we make better decisions? How come some of our decisions are predictably, reliably wrong? Why is it so hard to hire good people to fit a specific position? And how do we improve? So that was called Blink. The problem with this book is all of the stories that he went out and collected and put together in the book They all make me want to cry. And when I'm done crying, they make me want to scream. He chooses stories about racism and police violence and suicide and rape. And he uses these brutal stories to support and explore his main idea, which is, how do we talk to strangers? Do you get the disconnect? It's a good topic. I want to learn more about this topic. We as a species need to be better at this topic, but the examples are just disturbing. And even worse, I think they don't really prove his point. If you tell me that once upon a time there was a person who got pulled over by a cop and everything seemed to be going well, and then the person lit a cigarette and the cop lost his ever-loving mind and yanked the person out of the car, I would say, what an interesting story about the difficulty people have communicating with each other. No. I'd say, what the hell was wrong with that cop? And you'd say, oh, you don't understand. It was a white cop in Texas, and she was a black lady. I'm like, okay, that makes a little more sense, but how do we even hear about it? Because this isn't just his word versus her. I'd be like, no, she recorded the whole thing. He was going to get away with it, but she recorded the whole thing. Oh, what a great story about the difficulty of communicating with each other. No! That's a story about power. About people who have abused power for ages and got away with it. And the only reason they don't get away with it now is because little plastic squares are cheap. That's the only thing that changed. And that's not even the worst story. The worst story is about a girl who was unconscious when she was raped. In a book about how we can better communicate with each other, one of the characters in your story was unconscious. This story is not about communication. It is about abuse of power. And then he gets to the end of the chapter and he says, this is an example of why we need to deal with the problem in binge drinking. Binge drinking is the only reason the asshole got caught. Binge drinking was half the hero in that stupid story because he tried to run and he was too damn drunk. And that's why they caught him. The other half of the story, there's three heroes. One was the alcohol that made him fall over. One was the people who caught him. And three was the, or one, two, and three. Man, I can't even count. I'm so mad. And the third one was the stupid cell phone pictures that just irrefutable evidence in court that she was gone. She was gone. And that's not the worst part of the story. I wanted to know more about this story, so I went to Google, and I'm not making this up. I typed unconscious girl raped news story, and I hit enter because I wanted to know more details, more context. The story in this book did not make the front page. That's the problem. The story in this book is old news. It happens so often, we don't even notice it anymore. It didn't make the front page. These are not stories about communication. They're about how people have been getting away with rape and murder and abuse for generations. And the only reason we know is because the people without the power finally have a shred of proof. If the rapist only gets jail time because voicemail messages and smartphone snapshots prove the victim was not there, then the story is not about the difficulty discerning consent. And if you need a clue what it's really about, notice that the aggressor in that story got 6 months. Because the judge didn't want to wreck some poor boy's life over one mistake. That's what the story is about. It's about an old man sitting on a tall chair looking down at a young, regretful, sorrowful boy and thinking, that could have been me. And then he looked at an angry, victimized woman and he couldn't say that. He couldn't put himself in her shoes. See what I mean? Don't read the book. It'll make you mad. Or do. I'm not your boss. So if it made me mad, why did I want to come here and talk about it? It's because Malcolm Gladwell is not dumb. I know that I called him out, and I know that I'm angry, but even good-hearted, intelligent people can make dumb choices sometimes. You can ask my wife. She'll tell you. She'll volunteer the information if you don't ask. I make poor choices once or twice a year. So why did this smart person go to all this trouble to publish a book? Because scientists had discovered a few principles in communication and social sciences that are both very unintuitive and very helpful. One, humanity is a spectrum. We live on a bell curve, but in the middle, the majority of humans have a bias towards trust. Our default mode is trust, which means we are much more vulnerable to liars and abusers than we expect. That's worth knowing. It's not how I feel about myself. I feel like I'm a good judge of character, but science informs me that my feeling does not coincide with reality. Number two, the emotional displays that we read off other people, their facial expressions, their body language, are much less reliable than we expect. And the example he used here was really compelling to me because I've spent a lot of time reading about body language and facial expressions and all of this stuff and micro expressions, how you can read people. That's important to me. I'm interested in it. So this scientist decided he was going to put it to the test because he sees everybody talking about over here, how, well, if you pull your A1C muscle to the left 3 inches, it means this. And he's like, okay, well, if that's true, then it ought to apply across humanity, right? So let's find an isolated tribe that doesn't deal with humanity a whole lot. And let's see if pulling your A1C this far to the left still means I don't believe you. So when he went there and when he pulled out his cell phone, they were surprised. And instead of going, oh, which is what we think people do when they're surprised, they went. That was their cultural version of, oh my God. So it turns out that a lot of things that we believe mean a thing, they're just cultural constructs. And when we think we're being expressive, like when you, if you take a picture of someone walking in a room and then you surprise them and you snap a picture, they think they're going, but really they're going. Even our interpretation, we are opaque to ourselves. Other people are opaque to us. We are opaque to ourselves, and none of us is aware of it. That's good information to know. That's useful to hear. That's number two. Number three, if you add number one and number two, it means we are, as a species, reliably vulnerable to mediocre liars. And we are reliably cruel to innocent people who don't look innocent. That's good to know. That alone would have been worth the price of entry, just those three things. But he closes the book with one more gift. It's called the scientific concept is called coupling. And it's the idea that our actions are much more tightly tied to their context than we expect. We imagine that people who want to kill themselves will just find any old high spot and jump off of it. So therefore, you don't need to put up railings, because if you put up a railing over here, they'll just move 2 feet to the left and jump, right? That makes sense to us. But the science says it's not the case. The science says someone really, really has to work themselves up to thinking about killing themselves. And then they have to work themselves into a plan that their psychology can live with. And so the idea of killing themselves gets tied to a very specific place, like a certain section of bridge where no one's going to be around. So they feel like they can jump and no one will know. And if you fix the bridge in that one particular spot and just put up an extra high fence, you would think they would just move 4 feet to the left and go, but 4 feet to the left, the lights are brighter and they don't want people to know. So it turns out that instead of losing 95% of people, you lose 5% of people. It turns out that our decisions are highly context specific. If you make up a decision to kill yourself by putting your head in an oven, but then the carbon monoxide in the gas gets fixed, so putting in your head in the oven doesn't work anymore, you don't just go find a gun. You say, dang it. And you get on with your life 90% of the time. That's wild. I never would have expected that. But our decisions are context specific. The other one, the example he gives is crime. We imagine that if you go to a certain street corner where all the hookers live, and you start arresting hookers, the hookers will move one block to the left, right? That's what we think will happen. What the records show is that finding a corner where it's safe to be a hooker is really, really hard. And so if you make that corner an inhospitable place, the hookers would, it's easier to find a job than it is to find another safe corner. That crime is context specific. Our choices are context specific, which I think is why he talks about the stupid party and he talks about the drinking. It's like the context is they were binge drinking, and if you remove that context, the thing would have played out differently. I would argue. But I can at least see the point he's trying to make. He's trying to say that if we shift the context, we shift the behavior. That's useful to know. It was not something that I expected. And the reason that's the reason why I think he wrote the book, even though the book makes me mad. If human reactions are context specific, or he gets to the last chapter of the book is where he finally gets to what I think is his point, where he imagines that first traffic stop that went so wrong, and he imagines it in a new context. He says, what if instead of just randomly pulling over people on a safe road for no reason at all, and then going on a fishing expedition to try and find out what they're doing wrong, what if that exact same cop went to the 3-block radius where 90% of the crime actually happens and worked on fixing that neighborhood where the people would be actually grateful to see a cop for once? Then she would have just driven home at 5 miles over the limit, and the world would have gone on and this never would have happened. Or what if he had been trained to actually fix problems instead of fishing for problems? What if every time she had interacted with a cop, they were actively rescuing somebody? Do you think her reaction to that cop might have been different? Instead of every time she interacted with a cop, they had been fishing for drugs? If crime is context specific and human reactions are context specific, the stop could have been different. There's an old metaphor that says we need to stop pulling people out of the water and go fix the bridge. I think that's dumb. I think obviously we have to do both. the little saying is we need to stop pulling people out of the water and start fixing the bridge. Which sounds great, but I think it's dumb. Because if somebody is drowning in the water, you don't say, hold on, I need to engage in extensive infrastructure revitalization. You'd have to do both. And you don't just keep pulling people out of the water while there's a bridge out, right? You have to do both. There are two contexts in all of these horrific stories. There's the context of the individual person who went through it, and I don't think he's kind enough to them. I don't think he's careful enough with them. And then there is the context of the systemic structure around it that allowed it to happen. And I think in his own quiet way, that is exactly what he's trying to fix. If there are two contexts in every crime and they both need to be addressed, and the science that he's pointing us to is correct, then any second we spend addressing either of those two contexts is time well spent. I don't like the book. It made me mad, but I'm glad I read it. Which part? I said there's two contexts. There's the personal context of the person who went through the thing, and there's the systemic context around it that helped make that thing happen. And Gladwell is saying both of those contexts are critical to what happens in a way that we don't expect. Both of those contexts, if they're addressed, make fundamental lasting change in a way that we don't expect. So if we take the time, if we're the person who sees something happening and we're brave enough to stop it for that one person, we are the universe. And then if we go to the board of the school and say, we also, while we're helping this person, we also need to address systemic binge drinking on our campus, then that's time well spent. Because if you shift the context, you shift the behavior. So the book made me mad, but I'm glad I read it. Thank you for your time. I can tell people have questions. I encourage you to share your questions. It is weird how he packaged the title, isn't it? I think how to allocate trust properly in difficult situations would have been less catchy as a title. But I think that's what he was really trying to get at. The big takeaway for how to talk to strangers is just to recognize that you're bad at it. That we are predictably, reliably defaulting toward trust. And 80% of the time that works, that's why we have the default. Society needs to trust in order to function. So getting fooled is sort of the price that we pay for social function. And if we flip over to the other way and default to not trust, that actually has problems in itself, which is exemplified by the police officer who just pulled over flipping everybody for no reason at all. He was defaulting to distrust and therefore failing at his job. He wasn't stopping crime. He was just pissing off people. And it had predictable results. So if we accept that we're not good at trust, if we accept that we're not good at reading people, if we accept that we're opaque to them and they're opaque to us, then we will slow down, put less weight on our gut inferences and put more weight on what they actually do over time. So if someone smiles all the time and they're kicking puppies, that's not a person you want to be around. Like the one advice that I heard online is just watch how they treat wait staff. Watch how they treat someone who doesn't have power over them. Because if they're dismissive and rude, they're going to be dismissive and rude the instant you don't have power over them. So that's the talking to strangers tip is just recognize that you're bad at it. Yeah, I think a certain brand of Trumpism has definitely trained a significant minority of our population to default to distrust, which is the opposite of the way we're naturally wired, and the results are predictable. It's the reason why liberal societies succeed over closed societies, is because the closed society is constantly watching its own back, and that takes half your energy. So if you spend half your time afraid that someone's going to punch you, and the other person's spending 100% of their time moving forward, like the other person is going to get ahead. So I don't have an easy fix, but I think you're right. I think there is a significant chunk of our population that's been sort of brainwashed into defaulting to fear. And it is turning them inward in ways that are detrimental to the whole society. Which is, I think, a hint at something we can work on. Like if we are descending into tribalism, then the way to work your way out of tribalism is to expand your tribe. To reach across those tribal boundaries, recognizing how difficult that is. I don't have an easy solution, but if the problem is tribalism, then the solution is to expand your tribe, to make your tribe more winsome, to send out missionaries to try, well-trained missionaries to try and recruit people in, and to keep your tribe safe, keep your tribe strong, that all of that together helps your tribe expand. If you're in a situation where it's just tribe versus tribe, the best thing you can do is have a strong tribe, which is why I'm here. Now go in peace. Remember that talking with strangers is hard. You are not as smart or as effective at reading people as you think you are. They are not as understanding of what you're trying to express as they think they are. This is hard work. Cut yourself some slack. And when things go bad, don't attack the person, attack the context. Thank you.